Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 180th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During this show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is Imad Dura. He was born and raised on the Green Line in Beirut, Lebanon. That's the dividing line between warring factions in the Civil War. He experienced episodic violence through the 70s, 80s, and 90s while growing up, and then intermittently living his life in the times between. He and his wife, both physicians, came to the United States in 1995 and lived and worked first in New York and New Jersey before coming to rural Jonesport, Maine. Now Imad works in Lewiston as an infectious disease physician and lives with his wife and two sons, 10 and 18, in Cumberland. So welcome to New Mainers Speak, Imad.
Thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure. So I noticed that in 2009, the New York Times ranked Beirut as the number one travel destination worldwide due to its nightlife and hospitality. And Lebanon is bordered mostly by Syria and Israel to the south. The whole western coast lies along the Mediterranean Sea. So there are ancient forests, ski mountains, and ancient ruins, and much more to experience there. I wonder what you would suggest for people if they're going to visit Lebanon. What would they do?
In spite of the overpopulation, Lebanon continues to have several unspoiled areas that are very beautiful in terms of nature and beaches and mountains and valleys and rivers, and these would be great to visit. Nightlife is pretty exciting for those who are into that. The food is amazing.
Nightlife, are they talking discotheques? What's nightlife?
Yes, essentially nightlife is mostly discotheques. But even people who are not into discotheques, it's pretty common to stay up pretty late.
Like what?
Going out to concerts or eating out or visiting with friends. Bedtime tends to be after midnight.
Oh, okay. Not too crazy.
No.
So, did you ever get to do these things, like going out to the mountains when you were a child or a young adult in Lebanon?
Yes. Yes, of course. These were the formative years of my life, and these were split between the beautiful parts of the country, as well as, you know, the more overpopulated part of the city with all of its problems and violence.
It's quite dichotomous, you know, life spent some of the time in a bomb shelter and some of the time out in nature's wonders.
Yes, there are lots of contradiction in a place like Lebanon, and it's very surprising given the size of the country. It's a very small country. It's probably the size of Penobscot County.
And it's 6 million people.
It's about 4 million people.
Four million.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think that they've had a hard time doing a head count in recent years.
The head count is very controversial. It is a politically charged issue.
Because then once you see who's who,
exactly,
you'll want more representation one way or the other.
Exactly. So they better not have this data.
They're just guessing. Maybe they could do an ultraviolet or, you know, infrared and see how many warm bodies are on the ground. Can you tell us what life was like for your family of five living right on the Green Line in Beirut as you were coming of age?
I would say it was another one of those contradictions. We had a perfectly normal family life, interspersed with episodic and extremely severe violence. So there would be periods where the violence would be very close. There would be death and destruction and bombings, and you live in a bomb shelter. And then when that goes away, things are more normal. We have a normal family life, and we go to school, and we study, and then we go on a picnic, we go fishing, we go hunting, and then again, we're back into the bomb shelter. So it was very episodic. It tended to be pretty random also and surprising.
Yeah, so what happens when one day you're walking to school and everything's normal, and then the next day you know you can't count on that? Does that change the way you approach your studies or your family or you're thinking about yourself at all?
It changes the way you approach life. There is randomness in the events that can happen and that could put everything into question, whether you're current well-being or your current bad being or your current wealth or your current poverty, everything can change. You would feel randomly with a blink of an eye. You're doing well one day and then the next day you are staring death in the face.
Yes, I imagine that's unnerving. And you probably have to just let go a little bit because you can't control. You know, that's true for any of us, right? Things can happen, car accidents, random accidents. Cancer diagnoses, the things that we can't control. But I imagine when you have these outside attacks, that it's even more so.
Yes.
It would stimulate a different mindset.
Yes.
Yeah. So your parents were both teachers. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about them and what they valued and how they brought that to you as a family.
My parents were both school teachers in secondary high school, in a high school, essentially public high schools. My father subsequently became a high school principal. And this was a, you know, pretty good and stable middle class life that values education a lot, values reading. I lived in a small apartment that was... that probably had hundreds, if not thousands, of leather-bound books. So reading was the most important thing that we were doing other than doing our studies.
And where did all the books come from? Was there a...
Collections over the years by my parents.
Just your parents? They weren't passed down from generations?
No. My parents were the first generation in their family that had an education. So the generation of my grandparents on both sides was largely illiterate.
Oh, an education of any kind?
Yes.
I see.
Yes, they were illiterate, my grandparents. So the generation of my parents was the first generation that managed to go through school and then do some college.
Your family rose very quickly from illiterate to high school teacher and principal to physician.
And I'm hoping we did not plateau, but that's my fear.
Right. And you told me earlier that you have a sister in Canada and a sister in France.
Yes.
That's very much a Lebanese story, isn't it?
It's a diaspora. The Lebanese diaspora is all over the world. If you turn a rock in Alaska, you'll find the Lebanese.
Yes.
Yeah, it's everywhere. They're everywhere.
Do you have a way of identifying one another in public?
No, not really. Until they start speaking.
Special handshake?
No. But when they start speaking, you can identify them.
How's that? With the accent?
From the accent, yes. Mm-hmm.
And you grew up speaking French, is that correct?
No, Arabic.
Arabic. So
Arabic. French was a foreign language that we learned in school.
I see.
So that was only at school.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the first foreign language that we learned, and then English was added subsequently as a second foreign language. But the major language is Arabic.
And so when you arrived in the United States, did you have pretty secure use of English?
It was acceptable. I definitely enriched my vocabulary much more over the past 20 years, but it was enough to start medical training and communicate with people.
Yeah, I bet that was a steep learning curve for everything. You know, it's hard enough starting your residency, starting your residency and wondering what they mean by a lawnmower is another thing.
Yeah, I had Yes.
I understand that some of the EMTs that are being trained in the area now, they're working to get people from all kinds of backgrounds from different cultures because it's important to have them showing up. And in fact, the training takes a long time because they have to explain things like lawnmowers, just not a concept they have, much less a word.
Okay.
So Lebanon is the most religiously diverse population in the Middle East. Confessional political balance between the numerous factions in a country of roughly 4 million people is a pretty interesting solution. I wondered if you could kindly explain confessional politics.
I would rather not.
Okay. Yeah.
It's too complicated for such a short interview.
Sure. Yeah, so I think it's important just to note Lebanon is not all in agreement. It's not ubiquitous. There aren't just Muslims or just Christians.
It is a mosaic.
Yes.
It is a mosaic with a very delicate balance of power. And power is usually distributed based on confession. And people with...
Confession of which...
Of which religious background?
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure where that word came from. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's confessionalism.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And people without a religious group are not represented.
I see.
So you have to choose a side.
It seems like a variation on a political structure such as parliament, you know, where you have factions represented in different pie slices. And so they do that there in just a little different variety.
Except that lots of it is hereditary.
The political power?
Exactly.
Yes. So
it's not much choice that you have in terms of where you are going to be assigned.
It must be difficult to move things forward when all the leaders have different directions they'd like to be going in.
That's true. And that's why political paralysis is the name of the game.
So you've had some experience with that before coming here. You said that you and your wife are from opposite sides of the Green Line. I wonder if you could tell me how you two met and how your families responded to your Romeo and Juliet union.
We met in college, and we met after the communication between Eastern Beirut and Western Beirut was open. So that was after the period of civil war, and there was more free movement of people. And this is where we met in college, and we ended up getting married at the end. And the parents agreed, initially reluctantly, and then subsequently, you know, we developed a very good relationship with the parents of the other side, and it was more than acceptance.
It was embracing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it worked out at the end.
And did your sisters end up marrying people from the same side of the Green Line? Or?
I have one sister who is not married and another sister who is married to a Frenchman.
So a lot of variety and diversity even within your family, just like
exactly. All
of Beirut
yes. And
Lebanon. Pretty cool. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Imad Dura. He's a physician specializing in infectious disease working at Central Maine Med Center in Lewiston. He and his wife moved to the United States in 1995 and have practiced medicine here ever since. So, Imad, your professional life is all about giving care to people with all kinds of diseases, such as hepatitis and HIV/AIDS. Do you have a message for people that are listening regarding limiting the spread of infectious diseases in Maine? Anything, now that you have the microphone, the things you wish you could tell everybody?
Yeah, if they're interested in listening.
Why don't people want to know about infectious disease?
Okay, well, the idea is to prevent infectious diseases before we treat them. And some important things that can be done is get your vaccines. Do not believe the quacks who say that vaccines are bad. You're not going to become autistic from that. Use condoms. And do not believe the quacks who say that condoms do not protect from STDs. Do not do drugs. And if you really insist on doing drugs, do not share your needles. And that will help a lot.
Yeah.
That will help quite a bit.
Simple preventative measures.
Yes.
I imagine you do a lot of hand washing at your house.
Not really. We believe in the hygiene theory.
Yes.
Yeah. In the hospital, that's different.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Hospitals are on top of it. Has your practice changed at all with the rising temperatures of climate change? Do you see different diseases or more of one kind or the other?
We are seeing more infections caused by ticks and mosquitoes than ever before, and it is probably related to environmental changes related to climate change.
Yeah.
As well as other human factors, such as the way we live, where we build our homes, what activities we do. We're invading the territory of the ticks, so it's not surprising we're seeing more ticks.
Right, yeah, we're in it. And then we also go to destination weddings in Zika-borne environments.
Exactly, and these are problematic. So we are really invading wildlife, and it's getting back at us, and we're not helping with climate change.
And I understand there's a whole new set of concerns with the ticks now. There's some different diseases, secondary diseases that are coming along. Are you seeing those?
Occasionally we see things other than the standard diseases that we see from ticks, and probably scientists will continue to identify newer diseases with time.
Yeah, differentiating them. So that's probably somewhat different than when you first arrived in the state of Maine and went directly to work in Jonesport. They have a population of 1,300 people. I'd love to hear some stories about what that was like for you to be new to New England and pretty new to the United States. Were there any other immigrants up there? Or what was life like in Jonesport for you? And what was that, 94? 96?
No, that was after I finished my training. 2002, I went to Jonesport.
Okay, 2002 in Jonesport. What was life like there for you?
Well, Jonesport and Washington County in general. So I worked in Jonesport. I worked in Machias. I worked a little bit in Lubeck. Washington County in general is probably the most beautiful part of the state and maybe the most beautiful part of the world I've ever seen. And the population there, the people there are some of the most honest people I've ever worked with. Very honest, very earnest, very honorable. They go through life, they have lots of problems. It is an unforgiving environment, and they do unforgiving jobs, back-breaking jobs. They do not get their due, and they do not get the respect they deserve. It is unfortunate that they tend to be the butt of jokes in the state of Maine, which is nasty and unwarranted and very unfair. Very, very, very honest people. They can be rough around the edges. They are an acquired taste, good whiskey is an acquired taste. Pepsi Cola is not an acquired taste, but Pepsi Cola is stupid. like a place like Portland and its suburbs. It's a pretty cute, sexy place. Okay, but sometimes you just want to have a cup of coffee, an honest cup of coffee, and you do not care about the name of the farmer who grew the coffee beans. So it is essentially zero BS in a place like Washington County. They deserve much more. They deserve better economic development and a much better health system to deal with the issues that they are struggling with.
Yes. And the backbreaking labor up there, I'm guessing, is a lot of blueberries.
It's mostly fishing, digging for clams, blueberries, trawling for scallops, some lumber. It's very backbreaking.
I'm so happy to have you speak on behalf of the people of Washington County, because I've had very few guests with experience up that way, because I'm down here. It's difficult for me to access people up there. And so I very much appreciate that, the one main concept.
I think the only two other immigrants in Jonesport when I was there was one Filipino doctor and one Egyptian agronomist who worked on blueberries.
Interesting.
Yes, I think so. I've never met anyone else.
And how did the people up there respond to you as a new American?
Generous. I mean, at the beginning, because they are rough around the edges, you would feel that they are not necessarily welcoming until you understand the way they are thinking and the way they are talking. And they are generous and welcoming and loving. And I made good relationships. I was immensely respected more than anywhere else in the world. So that's the irony here, is that in some of the most racially less diverse parts of the state or the country, you would see less racism than in the more racially diverse parts of the country.
I think that's fascinating, and I've heard other things about that too. You know, when you basically burn your hard drive with people from many different places, you categorize them, and then you see things divided. But if you're just all one, and then you meet somebody from somewhere else, It's just a, oh, I'm this, what are you?
Exactly.
A little less judgment with it.
Exactly.
Well, I'm glad you were respected there and had a relatively easy introduction to the state of Maine. And a very interesting one, a very flavored one. You had come through the difficult and convoluted process of being a legal immigrant in the United States. Is there anything about that process that you can share with us to help paint a clear picture about what life is like for newcomers as they go through this steeplechase?
It's difficult to use my pathway as the classic pathway for immigrants because it's different. We did it the legal way, and we are physicians, so we do not go through the same struggles that other manual laborers go through, which is a blessing. I can summarize it this way. When I first, my wife and myself first came to the United States, we came on training visas. A training visa, once you finish your training, you're supposed to go back to your country of origin. You cannot stay unless you can have a 3 to 4 year contract in a underserved area, which means in a place that has been struggling to find physicians and they could not find an American physician. So my luck is I found a job in Jonesport and my wife found a job initially in Pittsfield and then subsequently in Bangor. It was not something easy to be together. It was only by luck because we could have found jobs in, you know, an airplane right away, which is kind of ironic for a country that that prides itself on what it calls family values. And you know, combining families together, uniting families does not seem to be a priority. And then after several years in a medically underserved area, such as Jonesport, you can apply for permanent residency, and a few years later it would be citizenship.
And so I'm imagining you became citizens somewhere along the way there?
Yeah, we became citizens, I think, in 2013, I think.
What was that process like for you?
It was just lengthy and convoluted, and any error along the way would make you into an illegal, and if you are an illegal, you are deportable.
For a mere traffic offense.
Every year we had to renew paperwork, and sometimes you would be afraid that you have made a mistake in one comma or one space on the application, and they will come back to you that there is something wrong with your application, and it has happened to others.
It's really scary because it's a hugely difficult process, and there are so many legal hoops to jump through. It would be easy to miss one. Even if, when you're doing due diligence, it would be easy to make a mistake.
Yes, the process is convoluted enough that the standard way of doing it is to pay a lot of money to a specialist immigration attorney.
Yes.
Which is what we have done.
And that is definitely, people with resources do that. And other people go to ILAP and benefit from the generosity of the attorneys who are offering their services pro bono for those who cannot. So when we were talking on the phone this week, you told me that your mom was an English teacher and that...
No, she's an Arabic language teacher.
Arabic language teacher. Excuse me. She was a language teacher. Maybe
yes.
I just... I inserted English in there. So she was an Arabic language teacher and cared very much about reading and literature.
Yes.
And that was a big part of your upbringing and your education. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about... any favorite childhood books you remember her reading to you, or other books that have been influential to you as you've moved through life, ones you go back to?
Unfortunately, over the past 20 years, I have hardly read any literature at all. I have read probably zero literature over the past 20 years. But in the first 30 years of my life, I read hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books, and they are partially the books that define who I am, because these are the kinds of books that when you turn the cover on the last page, you continue to live in the world of that specific book for several subsequent weeks or months, so it becomes imprinted in your life. Some of the most important things that I have read and that have defined who I am, I believe, are I knew you would ask me this question, so I'm trying to. I rehearsed some books that I really.
Good, way to be prepared.
Arabian Nights, Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, the Foundation series by Isaac Asimov. I was very affected by a play by Sartre called Dirty Hands. There is a tremendous, beautiful French novel called Froth on the Daydreams that affected me a lot by Boris Vian. I think these are the kinds of books that really end up affecting you for life and change your outlook on life and how you approach things and how you think about things.
And then you want to look for other people that know this bubble, that know this other world that was created.
And it's almost nobody. I was ecstatic when I discovered that there was another doctor in our hospital who has read the Foundation series.
Oh, what a joy. It's like speaking a special language together.
Yes, after asking thousands of people, have you ever read the Foundation series? No.
How fun. Didn't have that shared piece. So, Imad, you are a person who has really been a driven person, moving through life, meeting goals, and you always work to serve people in Maine, some of our most vulnerable citizens at that. You have very little time to yourself between your practice and raising a family, and I thank you so much for taking the time to come be with me on the air today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Kate Manahan, closing today's program with a song that Imad has selected for us. Can you tell us a little bit about why you chose this song to wrap things up, Imad?
It's a traditional song from the city of Latakia in Syria, and it is sung by a great Syrian singer, Lena Shamamian, called Yam Safira. And it is about the difficulties of immigration back in the days of steamships.
Thank you. لكن بخاف من الهوى
الشاي والضعيف حمل ثلاث